Last week I had a really funny conversation with Helen Schmidt. It's not a funny time that they're going through, but I think is Marty, is he 90? Is he 89 or 90? I mean, he's been around a long, long time. And I think that he has a very clear sense of his own mortality. And he has a great desire to go be with our Lord Jesus. And it is not something that he fears. And Helen is exactly in the same place. She has a great desire to be with our Lord Jesus. And that passing is not something that they fear. So we were talking about it. And it was funny. And we were talking about the way we'd want to go. I mean, it's kind of a morbid conversation, but we were talking about it. And it brought up a comment that Chuck Swindoll made, and I mentioned it to her, and she found it interesting. So I'll mention it to you. He said, you know, the comment I heard one time is, I want to go like my dad did, peaceful in his sleep. Not like the rest of the passengers in his car who were screaming. May it be that way for all of us. Peaceful. And in our sleep. Sorry, I had to say that. Just last week, I put up a quote. This was by A.W. Tozier, and I want to go back to it. He said, what comes into your mind when you think about God, or when you think of God, is the most important thing about you. What comes into your mind when you think of God is the most important thing about you. And just think about that. It drives everything about you. Your whole outlook on life, if you think about it, everything is guided by what you think of God. If you think you are God, I used to have a neighbor that thought she was God. Her whole life was driven by that thought that she was God. It reflected it. Other people have a view that God does not exist. And their whole life looks like that. It's totally self-consumed. What comes into your mind when you think of God is the most important thing about you. We need to think rightly about God. It does shape how we live. A friend of mine named Lowell Bakke, who he's considerably older than me. He's from Boulder, Colorado, like I am. He was a pastor in Boulder who moved to Tacoma long before we moved up here. And when I made the transition from Colorado to Washington and was looking for some help and just kind of getting stable, I met with him and just kind of caught up with him. And he had left a fairly large church in Boulder, come up and planted a church in Tacoma. It had grown, I think, to about 1,000 people. And then he left the church. And when I met him, he was studying. He was working towards a doctorate of ministry at a school in Seattle. And so I just wanted to catch up with him. You know, how's your life and what have you been doing? He says, well, I left the pastorate to take care of my mother and my mother-in-law. They were both dying. So he left a church of about 1,000 people to be the caretaker for two women who were going to be passing away. They were both in their 80s. He said it was one of the most fascinating things to participate in their lives with them, because one person, and I think it was his mom, dearly loved Jesus. And she was such a joyful, joyful woman. And the other woman, his mother-in-law, did not have a faith in Jesus. He said she was bitter. He said it was interesting to watch these two women as they came towards the end of their lives. One lived like this. Just, I don't need anything I have. Everything I have, I'm not going to take it with me. I'm not going to need it where I'm going. It doesn't matter. Just take it. She was joyful. I mean, just interactions with her were just joyful ones. His mother-in-law, I don't think I have it back, but I think this is the way it was. He said she was desperate, just holding on to everything. But with both, neither could hold on to anything. And as their lives just slipped away, so did everything that they had held to be precious, except for one thing, and that was what his mom held to be most precious, which was her relationship with Jesus Christ. She didn't lose that. She was ushered into the face-to-face relationship that she so longed for, and which characterized the desire for that and the anticipation of that and the hope for that, which so characterized her life, was realized in that moment. He says that just in all of his years of being a pastor and walking with people through difficult and deep times, he said just walking with two women, both in the same boat, but each one with a different hope, he said it was so touching and meaningful to him. We need to think rightly about God, because what we think of God is the most important thing in our lives. But also, if we are to desire God, it is imperative that we desire the God who is, and not a God of our own imagination. His mom desired the God who is, and not a God of our own imagination. Unfortunately, there are some things about God that we can know to be true, so that we are not creating a God of our own imagination. There are people who have encountered God, and in those encounters, they've discovered things about God that radically changed their view of reality. And it gave them a hope that set them on a course that pushed up like this until the time they passed from this earth and on into the presence of God. They learned that there is truth that they can stake their lives on, and we need to be talking about that truth. And this morning I want to talk about one of those human encounters with God and what the person learned from it. But before I mention the encounter, I just want to talk about what he learned, so that as we talk about his encounter, you just see these truths of God that just saturate his whole encounter with God. The first thing that he learned about God is that God is self-existent. And we are not. But God is self-existent. He was not created by anyone or anything. So he answers to no one except himself. I hate to say it, but that comes as a shock to some, that God does not answer to anyone but himself. Because our world is full of people who try to manipulate God to bend him to their way. But God does not answer to anyone but himself. And we need to be sure that when we approach God, we're not approaching him to try to bend him to our will as if he is dependent on us for his own existence. That's the first thing about God that we can know to be true from this experience that I'm going to be mentioning. The second is this, that God is self-sufficient. Now, we are not self-sufficient. I've heard one of the funniest comments I ever heard a mother-in-law say about her son-in-law was that he was a self-made man. That's not possible. There are no self-made men in this world. We are all dependent on our Creator. No one is self-existent and self-sufficient other than God. But because God is self-sufficient, he's not one who will be manipulated by anyone, because he doesn't need anyone. We can't bend him around our wishes as if he needed something from us. We can't enter into a relationship of manipulation with him. He is complete in himself, and he doesn't need our help. This is something that was very freeing for me, and I'll talk about this later. It was freeing for me to realize that God does not need my help to accomplish anything. He is self-existent. And then the third thing that we'll see this morning is that God is eternal. He is eternal. He is not limited by time. That's a difficult thing for us to grasp, because we are limited by time. We have a beginning and we have an end in this physical world that we live in. God is not limited. He has unlimited patience. I mean, just imagine if you were eternal. You'd be in no hurry at all. Why would you be in a hurry? You have unlimited patience. Why not? His view of what matters stretches out beyond the end of our earthly lives into eternity. This is the God who is. And this is the God who has given us an invitation to relate to Him. So the encounter with God that I want to talk about today is quite familiar to many. It is the meeting between Moses and God in a burning bush. I love that God would meet a person through a bush. Isn't that great? As if God needed us to do anything for Him. He chose a bush. Later on, He chose a donkey. We should not be so brazen and so bold as to think that God would need us to accomplish anything for Him if He met a man in a bush. So, if you ask a Jewish man or a woman to tell you what was the most important thing in the history of the Hebrew people, he would undoubtedly say that it took place about 3,400 years ago when God rescued the Hebrew people from slavery in Egypt. That was a very defining moment in their history. He took them from a time of being slaves under the most powerful nation in the world at that time, and He led them through 40 years, they wish it was days, 40 years of desert wanderings, and then He drove out the inhabitants of the land that He had promised to give them, and then He established them as a nation. It was so improbable that no one could have dreamed it up. This nation of slaves, captive in the most powerful nation in the world at that time, was ushered out, carried through 40 years of wandering through a desert that was incapable of sustaining them. Taken to the edge of a land that was full of those who were enemies, and God drove them out and planted them there. Drove out the people of the land and planted the Israelites in that land. And it began with God's personal visit to Moses. So I just want to talk a little bit about Moses to begin with, because we always see Moses towards the end of his life, but you know, there's 80 years that went on between the time that we see so much of who he was and the time that God encountered him. Moses was a pretty unique guy. He was born under a death threat, and then he wound up being Pharaoh's adopted grandson. What a great turn of events. To be born under a death threat and then be adopted by Pharaoh's daughter when he was 3 months old. He grew up in the king's palace instead of being killed for being a Hebrew. And he lived 40 years as Egyptian royalty. That's a turn of events that most people would like. He lived in the most powerful family of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth at that time. Anything he wanted, he could have. Luke writes this about him in Acts. He said, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. He was trained to know and fear the pantheon of Egyptian gods. They had a god for everything, for every location and every natural phenomenon. They believed that there was a god that would control that. And so they worshipped them and tried to manipulate them to achieve their own ends. And that was what Moses was raised in. He was aware. But Moses was also a Hebrew, and he knew it. When he was 40, he witnessed an Egyptian beating a Jew. So he killed the Egyptian. And that did not sit well with Pharaoh. And it wasn't the killing of the Egyptian that didn't sit well with Pharaoh. Because quite frankly, Pharaoh, as one who is worshipped as a god himself, had the power and authority to kill anyone that he wanted to. And I would assume that that extended to his household. that his household would look be looked at as a almost a demigod, as a demigods themselves. For the grandson of Pharaoh to kill an Egyptian because he was doing something he didn't want him to do is not something necessarily that would have driven Pharaoh to want to kill Moses. But Moses' act was an act of treason. He killed the Egyptian because the Egyptian was harming a slave. And the slaves were the enemies. The Hebrew slaves were the enemies of Egypt. So Pharaoh decided to kill the traitor Moses. And Moses fled for his life. And he ran to what must have seemed like the most distant, obscure place on earth. I don't know if anyone here in all of your... we have a church full of people who love to travel. I'd be curious about this. We have a church full of people who love to travel. And I love listening to the stories of the places that you all go. Has anyone here ever been to Petra? You did? Okay, we have one who has been somewhere near where Moses went. I could probably choose just about any other place on earth that people might have gone, but only once been to the desert of Midian. Was it as desolate as it seems? It was beautiful. Was it desolate?
Okay.
Now, the place that we're talking about, if you've ever watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and they go down through that kind of looks like a dry riverbed with red rock beside it, that's Petra. That's in the Midianite desert. But if you remember back to the scenes before that, before they went down into that beautiful carved, windswept under spot, it's just desolate. It's rock and barely a scrub. It's hard living. It's the complete opposite of Egypt. It's dry and desolate. When you think of the moon, think of Midian, but about 110 to 120 in the shade. It's so far from civilization that even now, if you started walking, it'd take you 20 days to get to a shopping mall or a Starbucks. It is a long way from anywhere. Even now, we avoid it. There's nothing to do there except sit under a rock and watch sheep look for tufts of grass. And Moses went from the royal courts of Egypt to that desert. That was a huge switch. 40 years of royalty and 40 years living in a desolate place. And he had no intention of leaving that desolate place. He settled in Midian. He got married. He had two sons, and he became a sheep herder. He spent the next 40 years living in complete obscurity. He must have felt, at that point, like the most forgotten man on earth. He named his first son Gershom. When you look at the roots of those two words, it comes from two words. The first one is stranger. And the second one is desolate. And when you put those together, it means lonely, desolate, stranger. This was what Moses felt. I am a lonely, desolate stranger in this place that God appears to have totally forgotten. And we don't really see much in the Bible to tell us about Moses' religious thoughts over those 80 years. But the little that we have, we get a picture of a man who has placed his confidence in God and his promises, even in that place. There's a couple places we can turn, and I think it's helpful as we consider who he was before we think about his encounter with God. One place is, again, back to Acts, and hear what Luke has to say. Luke said that Moses went to his people and saw an Egyptian mistreating the Hebrews, so he avenged the action by killing the Egyptian. And he writes, Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. So in Moses' own mind, he understood that God was going to rescue these people, and he thought in that moment God was going to use him. And that's why he killed the Egyptian. Another place that you can turn is Exodus chapter 18. And this is in the naming of his second son. The first one he named Desolate Stranger. But the second one he named Eliezer. And when you look at that word, it means my God is helper. So even in that desolate place, Moses' mind and his heart was still fixed on God. But I think the most enlightening passage about Moses is in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 24 through 27. Just hear what the writer of Hebrews has to say about Moses. It said, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as a greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. In his mind's eye, Moses saw God fulfilling his promise to send a Savior. You know, his understanding of Christ would have been very limited at that time. But one thing is for sure, Moses wanted to be associated with the people through whom God's deliverance would come. And he was willing to walk away from the most privileged position on the face of the earth to be part of that. That's a challenge for us too. In Moses' mind's eye, he saw God's deliverance of his people. And he was willing to walk away from his most privileged position on earth with all of its stuff and all of its reputation and all of its just benefits to himself to be part of the plan of God for the future. So we pick up a story in Exodus chapter 3, verse 1, and I just encourage you all to open up your Bibles to this passage and read along. As far as I'm able to determine, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is Moses' first encounter with God. He knew of God, but this is his first encounter with a living God personally. This is an autobiography. We understand that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. This is an autobiography of Moses done in the third person. He's writing of himself. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Horeb means desolation. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw, though, the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I'll go over and see this strange sight. Why, the bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses, can you imagine? Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. And then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And Moses said the most sane, rational thing that could possibly have been said in that moment. He said, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "Well, I will be with you." And then he approached it from a different angle. He said, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and I say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'Who is his name?' Well, then what shall I tell them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." This is what you are to say to the Israelites: "I am has sent me to you." God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation.'" That was not an easy encounter for a man who had spent 40 years in a desert, sitting under rocks to keep cool, watching sheep. Probably at this moment, assuming that God had done all that he was planning to do with him, and at 80 years old, his time was short. Did you notice that God did not answer Moses' first question? Moses asked, "Who am I that I should do this?" That's a very logical question for an 80-year-old who has spent the previous 40 years hiding out in the desert and who has a death sentence over him for treason. That's a very logical question. But God let Moses know that he was not going to be speaking alone. The one who was speaking out of a bush was going to go with him and speak through him. That should give anybody some courage. If the one speaking out of a bush is going to go and enable you to speak. So Moses, of course, brought up a second concern. He asked God how he would explain this to the Israelites, who were sure to wonder about this person who ran away 40 years before and was now appearing to them and giving every evidence of having dreamed up a massive escape plan. What would he say to them? He said, "They're not going to believe me. So who shall I say sent me? I wouldn't have believed him either." So God told him to tell them that "I am" sent him. The Hebrew words that God used can be translated one of two ways. The first one is what we read: "I am that I am." God is self-existent. The other way that they can be translated is, "I will be what I will be." When God said to Moses, "I am who I am," he was expressing something true about himself. He was expressing the fact that he is self-existent. He is self-determined. Everyone else is dependent on him, but he does not depend on anyone. Paul wrote this about Jesus. He said, "By him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." This is what Paul said of Jesus. The universe exists because God willed that it should. The earth and everything on it exists because God willed that it should. But God does not depend on anyone or anything for his own existence. He exists because he wants to. God exists because he wants to. He will be always what he wants to be. Nothing came before him to cause him to exist, and nothing will come after him to cause him to go away. This is the God we have faith in. And it matters, because if God is who he will be, then no attempt to manipulate him for the good or the bad will work. The only thing that matters is that we trust him and we obey him and that we love him our self-existent God. He is the source of everything. And we should be seeking Him in everything. The answers to our questions about life are found in the One who created everything. Well, not only did Moses learn that God is self-existent, but he also learned that God is self-sufficient. All that God is, He is in Himself. John writes this, "For as the Father has life in Himself, so He has granted the Son to have life in Himself." This is an important point. If God is self-sufficient, then does He need something from you? This is a rhetorical question. I'd like you to think of what it is that God needs from you. Is there a task that God needs you to do? Is He depending on you to do something? Because if He is dependent on you, then He's not self-sufficient. He does not need us. He does not need our friendship. He does not need our help. He does not need us even to defend Him. He does not need us to speak for Him. He'll speak for Himself through a bush or through a donkey if He wants to. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I that could possibly do this?" And again, God didn't answer. The only thing He said was, "I'll be with you." Because He doesn't need help. But Moses did, just like we do. I just want you to be encouraged by something. The next time you feel inadequate to a task that God has called you to, I want you to remember that you probably are. So the next time you feel called to a task by God and you feel inadequate to it, I just want you to remember that you are. You are inadequate to the task. That's what makes you the perfect candidate for it. Because God does not choose you out of His sense of need. He chooses you because He wants to be in relationship with you and work through you and encourage you by letting you see that He has you in His mind and He has you in His heart. He doesn't need you. You know, again, I mentioned this before, but one of the most freeing moments in my life was the day that I discovered that God does not need me. I mean, before that, I was pretty frantic. There's a lot of stuff to be done. I mean, there's a lot of need out there. I've got to get going. But that's God's world out there. He doesn't need me to be frantic about what is in His hand to care for. He has this world comfortably in His hand. He has called us, as He did Moses, to go and work, but not out of His sense of need. We don't have a relationship of mutual dependence, God and I. I need Him, and He does not need me. But He does choose to work with us anyway. And I don't know about you, but that fascinates me. Doesn't that? The Creator of the universe, who does not need us for His existence, for His sustenance, chooses to work with us instead. He could have stayed distant, but He came near. He could have worked through anything, but He chooses to work through human beings. I mean, I find that fascinating, that He chooses us. I mean, the One who created the universe and who doesn't need anything from it has chosen to relate to us and work through us. I'm fascinated by that. How can we not love Him? The Creator of this universe, who doesn't need the universe. The Creator of this earth, who doesn't need this earth. The Creator of the trees and the sea and the fish of the sea and the birds and the animals and human beings doesn't need any of it. But He made it. I'm fascinated by that. And it drives me to ask the question of why. And God, who doesn't need my help, calls me to join Him in His work and to relate to Him. It drives me to love Him, that the Creator of the universe would have me in His sights and choose me to enter into His work with Him. It drives me to love Him and appreciate Him profoundly, and it should you too. I think King David understood this when he wrote the 8th Psalm, and I think about the words that he spoke. He said, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, all that swims the paths of the sea. Oh Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." This is our response to God, who has created the heavens and the earth and then given it to us to care for. He's made us His image bearers, and He's crowned us with honor and glory, and He put creation under our care. And we deserve none of it. We deserve none of it. One of the most beautiful things that we will hear in heaven when we stand before Him is the song of those who are singing His praises in realization that they don't deserve to be there. And one of the things that we should be doing here is singing God's praises, knowing we don't deserve the place He's given us. We don't deserve this universe or this world. We don't deserve the relationship with Him or the position He's given us as caretakers of this creation of His. But He has. He's given this to us. It should drive us to our knees and to love Him. His heart is inclined towards us. And not only so, but He loves us. I mean, there's nothing lovely about us that would cause God to be so inclined towards us other than the fact that He wants to. He just simply wants to. It's an expression of who He is. He's self-existent. He's self-sufficient. And yet, He created us because He wants relationship with us. And I have often wondered why that should be. I mean, I consider my life and I wonder, God, why is it this way? And I go back to what Moses learned on that mountain in front of that bush that God was speaking through. And he learned that God is eternal and that God has eternity in view. And he learned in that moment that God had him in view for eternity. Moses, I mean, I just think about what people try to make of life. Moses was 80 when God met him in the desert. Moses was in a place that he considered desolate and forgotten. He felt like he was forgotten by God. And he discovered that God would use his entire lifetime and every joy and sorrow in his life to draw Moses into a relationship of dependence and trust. And he would take his whole lifetime to do it because his lifetime was not the end. I remember a quote by Marshall Shelley after two of his children died. At a fairly young age, Marshall Shelley was the son of a professor of church history named Bruce Shelley at Denver Seminary. He said, "It would be a shame if my children were created only for this earth." Fortunately, they were not. And in that moment of God's encounter of Moses in front of that bush, Moses would have said the same thing. "It would be a crying shame if I was made only for this earth. But fortunately, I am not." Because he saw the eternal view of God demonstrated in that moment. I mean, from a human perspective, Moses' life had been a terrible waste. The man who could have made a difference for his people had ran away. He ran away from the scene. Those people continued to suffer for another 40 years while Moses hid out in the Arabian desert as a sheep rancher. He was 80. I can't even imagine the despair that he felt of life and hopelessness. Just, what do? You're in the desert and you're a sheep rancher. Zipporah, the scene must be played out every morning. Zipporah walk in the morning. Good morning, Moses. What are you going to do today? I'm going to do the same thing I do every day. I'm going to go out into the hot sun and I'm going to watch my sheep graze. And I'm going to do that until the day I can't get up and do it again. My day, my life is, I can see the end of it here every day the same. And I'll get to the end and that'll be it. All of his plans and ambitions totally exhausted. He was finished. But God had not abandoned Moses because God had eternity with Moses in view. Every day in that hot sun, God was molding Moses' heart and preparing him. And every day God made Moses more aware of just how small Moses really was and how much Moses needed and depended on God. And it was in that brokenness that Moses wrote the 90th Psalm. He said, "Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They're like the new grass of the morning. Though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it is dry and withered. The length of our days is 70 years, or 80, if we have the strength, maybe 90, some 100. Linda's grandmother is 103, still going. She has the strength. Yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away." People are working hard to try to make that span longer, to stave off the end of it and to do away with the trouble and sorrow that fill it from beginning to end because they don't truly believe there's anything beyond it. We find ourselves in the position of the two women that I talked about when I first began. We're either approaching our lives in bitterness because we don't see there's anything beyond the end of it and that God is not real, or we're approaching our life with hope and anticipation because we see eternity in view. And we see that God is using everything in our lives to draw us closer to Him in anticipation of the future with Him. So we're either working towards bitterness or we're working towards hope. It's one of those two. So just consider this. What would you do if you had a good 150 years in this body of yours? Not 70. What would you do if you had 150? What would you do if you knew you had 500? I mean, really, what would you do if you considered your life and you saw, I have 2,000 years to live? It would look really different than now. I mean, the urgency of life would just totally disappear. And with every experience, you'd thank God and ask Him to help you see Him more clearly through it, if this was what He desired. Well, what about if your life would never end? How would you live it differently now? Would you live it with hope? Would you live it like this? Would you live it like this? One of the difficulties we have in America is we have a task-oriented mindset. You know, we set goals, we organize the process, we take the steps, we check it off the list. This is how we approach life. We've got a start date, we've got an end date. So I started here, I'm going to end there. There's nothing past that, so hold on tight. What if that list just went away? That's what happens when we embrace Jesus and the eternity that He desires for us in relationship to Him. So I just want to challenge you today to consider this God is self-existent, and He is self-sufficient, and He is eternal. He doesn't need you, but He desires relationship with you. And He's calling you into a relationship through Jesus Christ. Will you choose that, or will you choose to live life bitter and holding on to that which you cannot hold on to? I'd like to have the worship team come up and close today with a song entitled Jesus, Draw Me Near, because this is what He desires to do, to draw you near. But He's looking for your invitation. So let's sing, Jesus, Draw Me Near.
Jesus, draw me close.
I'm just aware that there are many people in this room right now who feel a little bit like Moses out in a desert that is desolate, who feel like the most forgotten people on the face of the earth, who just desire that you would come near, that you would show them your love for them and show them your self-sufficiency and self-existence. Show them that you are eternal and that your plans for them are eternal, that your heart is for them. Lord, I just would ask for your comfort on the people here today. Lord, that they would leave here encouraged by the God who is. That they would, again, understand your heart of love for them in making this universe that didn't need to be made, that you didn't need, in making this garden that we live in that didn't need to be made, in making them who didn't need to be made, but all of this made because of your heart of love towards humanity. Lord, I just would ask that each one would consider the incredible act of love demonstrated by you in sending your Son to die in their behalf as the just penalty for human rebellion, for their own rebellion against you. Lord, give the people of this place a profound appreciation today for who you are. Set their feet light today. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. So go in peace.